Today's episode of Ariel Helwani's MMA show contains explicit language that may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Back in your life on this Wednesday, October 16, 2019. Hello again, everyone. I'm Ariel Helwani. Hope you're having a lovely week. Welcome back to another episode of the Helwani Show pod. That's what I'm going with. Some of you were a little confused. I don't know why you were confused, but some of you were confused about the names and whatnot. Helwani Show pod, all right? Hopefully that satisfies all your concerns. It's another Wednesday. We got a great show planned for all of you. We were off last Wednesday for Yom Kippur. I was fasting around this time last week. It was tough. 25 hours, no food, no water. I missed you dearly, but we're back to our regularly scheduled programming this week. And we got a lot to discuss, of course, coming off Tampa. Yuani on Jacek back. Some people saying she's back. The queen is back. I thought she never really left, to be honest. Only lost to Rose Namajunas at 115, went up to 125, lost to Valentina Shevchenko, beat Tisha Torres. Shevchenko's tough, arguably the second best female fighter on the planet, regardless of weight class. Had a horrible weight cut against Rose Namajunas going into that first fight against Rose Namajunas. Not trying to revise history here, but them's the facts. Second fight was close. Like, this idea that she fell off, that she wasn't as motivated, that she wasn't as good, I thought was a little premature, and I think she reminded everyone, as the great Roy Jones Jr. once said. I said this on Monday, but I can always use an opportunity to use this quote. Y'all must have forgot how good she is. So is she next for Zhang Weili? That remains to be seen. Zhang is actually in New York City this week, then going to Boston. So we'll see her. We'll hear from her. And of course, Tatiana Suarez telling me on Monday that she's not healthy enough to return anytime soon. So it seems like Joanna is the front runner. We'll find out soon. And then of course, on Friday, we've got the UFC in Boston with a really fun card headlined by Chris Weidman versus Dominic Reyes. Number one contender fight at 205, potentially. I think if Weidman wins, he'd be a shoo-in, just because I think that Jones's team feels like they've diluted the brand a little bit these days, fighting these lesser-known fighters. They want a big name. Weidman fits the bill, former champion at 185. If he has an impressive victory over a previously undefeated fighter in Dominic Reyes, I think that he would be a perfect guy. Of course, there's Johnny Walker and Corey Anderson fighting in just a couple of weeks in Madison Square Garden. And John Jones is just like every hour trying to spark some kind of fight with someone else. Right now it's Israel Adesanya. Yesterday it was Anthony Johnson. Recently it was Chris Weidman. The man is thirsty. The man is anxious and itching to get back in there. But he wants a big fight, so he's trying to generate one. So that's the state of MMA right now. There's also the PFL playoffs coming up on Thursday on ESPN2 and ESPN Plus. By the way, the Friday card is on ESPN2 prelims and main card, not on Plus this time. So later in the program, I'm excited about this. We're going to talk to Micah Brown, who's the director of the new 30 for 30 called Chuck and Tito, the very first MMA-centric 30 for 30. If you're unfamiliar with 30 for 30, it's a documentary series that's been going on here at ESPN for over 10 years. They initially started it as 30 films to celebrate the 30-year anniversary of ESPN. 10 years later, they just celebrated their 40-year anniversary, and they've just kept the name, and it's become a great brand in the world of sports documentaries, probably the leading brand now. It has overtaken HBO Sports, in my opinion. And so yesterday they aired the 30 for 30 on Chuck and Tito. It's going to, if you missed it, it's going to be on ESPN Plus beginning this Friday. And it's a look at their rivalry and how it coincided with the rise of the UFC and the third fight, which was somewhat depressing, and the relationship with Dana White and all that stuff. So we'll talk to Micah Brown about the making of that film. Midway through the show, we'll talk to Mark Kriegel, who in my opinion is arguably the best boxing writer in the world right now. He's a phenomenal writer. He's had three really good pieces just in the last week or so. Also works for the NFL Network. But he actually sat down with George St. Pierre, our old friend, and his protege, Artur Beterbiev, undefeated boxer who is competing this Friday on the top rank card. And George is sort of a mentor to Artur, and Mark sat down with him, had lunch with him at a restaurant in Montreal, and actually talked a bit about GSP's career. So we'll talk about that, some things in boxing, comparing boxing to MMA, all that stuff and more. I can't wait to talk to Mark. He's a great, great character and a straight shooter and just a really fascinating guy. But first, let's go to our old friend Mark Raimondi of ESPN to talk about a few things that he has been working on as of late. Mark, how are you?
What's up, Ariel?
Wow, you sound crystal clear.
Well, I got this this new app that Troy hooked me up with.
Wow. Troy, TST, getting things done.
That's what we do, Ariel. Only the best for you. You know that.
Well, I don't know if that's always the case, but I do appreciate this little wrinkle right over here. This is great. So thank you, Mark. Thank you for joining us. Okay, let's talk about a few things you've been working on. Let's start with last week. You were at the first installment of the PFL playoffs in Las Vegas. You actually got great access. You were behind the scenes. You were in the locker room, often places that, you know, journalists aren't allowed to go to on a fight night. And this was kind of a wacky one because of the playoffs and guys are fighting twice on the same night in order to advance to the finale. What did you think of the experience? What was it like?
It was really one of my favorite fight night experiences of my career because I was not just bolted on press row watching what was going on in the cage. In fact, I watched actually very little of the fights because the real story to me, at least in PFL and the playoffs, is what's going on backstage and how, you know, we see fights every week, you know, multiple times per week. But when you're fighting twice in the same night, a lot of what is going on and what ends up in the cage is what you're doing backstage. And man, I was literally a few feet away when PFL president Ray Sefo informed Chris Curtis that he would have to fight again. He wasn't supposed to. He retired. He lost his first fight. He was done. He was about to eat a plate of chicken and waffles when Ray Sefo told him that the guy who beat him, Magomed Karimov, was out of the fight, and Curtis had to go fight Ray Cooper in a matter of minutes. You know, in like 30 minutes, he had to go fight. He was about to eat a plate of chicken and waffles. It was wild, man. It was wild.
So, did you talk to him? Like, he retires, right? And then
yes.
He's going to indulge in this chicken and waffles dish. Did you talk to him before he found out? Like, because to me, it's kind of scary. When you retire and you go through the emotions of actually saying I'm done and you go through the emotions of actually posting it, right, on his social media.
Yes.
And then someone's like, no, 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 you're not done. That's a scary thought. Like, we've talked about fighters who've talked about retirement. They have one foot in, one foot out, and then you're kind of coerced into taking another fight for whatever reason. But here you have a guy who's literally fresh off of losing and calling it quits and is almost dragged back out there. I know this was celebrated as some sort of fun thing. I felt a bit uncomfortable about it, to be honest.
I understand what you're saying, and I didn't actually get a chance to sit down and interview him at all. I was kind of fly on the wall, and immediately after the fight against Magomed Karimov, he came back to his dressing area and actually just sat down and was, he had his head in his hands and he was crying. So I didn't approach him at that point to talk to him. And then the next time I saw him, because there's so much going on back there, it's nuts. The next time I saw him was literally when he was in the buffet line picking up some food, and Ray Sefo approached him. And look, he's a fighter. I mean, I know that he retired, but he was able to turn it on pretty quickly. You know, they told him that he had to go back out there and fight. And he was pretty much game. You know, once he kind of processed the situation, he was game and he was ready and he was back in his locker room getting his hands wrapped. He could have said no. I mean, there were other fighters there who were healthy and ready to go. You know, Sada Boussi, who lost in the quarterfinals, was ready to go. He was hanging in his dressing room. He had his feet up on a chair. Like, he was completely healthy. He could have gone if needed, but Curtis was the guy that lost that fight against Magomed Karimov. He was the guy they chose to put in, and after a few seconds of just figuring out what the hell they were asking of him, he was ready to go again. And I think, you know, that draw of like, hey, I can win this fight and then go and fight for $1 million in December, I think that was a motivational factor. So it was just crazy to see the roller coaster of emotions going on back there.
How would you describe the scene backstage for PFL because, you know, UFC is a well-oiled machine. Bellator has been doing this for around 10 years or so. PFL is kind of the new kid on the block. Of course, they used to be WSOF, but I think they have a reputation of being, you know, not quite as buttoned up as the other ones. Like, did it feel like the Wild West back there, especially because it's a playoff event where, you know, they're scrambling to get guys to take these fights on very short notice and to fight twice same night? Like, what did you make of the actual scene and how the operations were running?
The operations were fine. The chaos came from the fact that fighters were fighting twice in one night, and they had to go to medicals, get cleared, go back to their dressing area, and then, you know, whatever it is they do, most of them were just kind of hung out and tried to relax and bring their heart rate down, only to, you know, get it back up, you know, a half hour, 45 minutes later before they have to fight for a second time. The chaos really came from just the fact that there were people running around. There's cameras back there trying to shoot fighters as they watch who their possible next opponent could be. There was a camera trying to get into Magomed Karamov's room when he was sick, and they were told, like, no, you can't come in here. John Crouch, who's the coach for David Mashaud, is like looking for someone to grab Mashaud's hands from the commission because people are just scrambling, running around. Ray Cooper didn't actually know that he was fighting Curtis. He thought he was fighting Magomed Karamov almost right until he walked out. He was watching it on television. And he just saw the graphic change. No one actually went back there and told him. He actually saw it on TV. It was pretty nuts.
I said in my column today that I think that they need to refresh the entire roster, that they need to – I threw a number, like 90% of the roster needs to change for next season, because it does feel like we're watching the same playoffs over again. I know that's not exactly 100% true, but the biggest names are here from last year. Like in this particular card coming up on Thursday, it's like Lance Palmer and Chris Wade. Like, all these guys were there last year. Ray Cooper, same thing. Magomed Karimov, Mago Millions, as they call him. It just sort of feels like the same thing from last year. Like, do you feel like it's a little bit stale? Like, it seems like they've invested so much in the format, but not as much in the actual roster, which at the end of the day, it's always about the fights and the fighters and the stories. And how many times can you tell the story of the guy going for $1 million? At some point, you have to freshen it up, in my opinion.
I see that perspective. I also see the perspective of, it's interesting when it is the same roster, because that's kind of how it is in the big team sports, right? It's the same teams vying for that prize every year. And here it's like you can tell the story from year to year of where these guys were and where they are now. There's a great story with Ray Cooper. You know, he's going for $1 million again. He had the chance last year, didn't pull it off. Now he has the path to the title against David Mashaud on New Year's Eve. So that part is interesting to me, because you can compare from year to year, you know, what the trajectory of these fighters are doing in the regular season, the playoffs, down to the finals. But I do think that you do want to refresh at least a little bit of the roster. I do believe that. I don't think it should be the same season over and over again with the exact same names. But I don't have a problem with keeping the big names, you know, the Lance Palmers and, you know, the Ray Coopers and the Magomed Karamovs and so on and so forth. You know, the Andre Harrisons of the world. I think that's good. And then, you know, you can bring in fighters who can try to challenge those guys who have won the titles, you know, like the Vinny Magalhaes, the Natan Schultes, those kind of guys.
Yeah, it seems like a keeper fantasy league that you're not really just, like, you're just sticking with.
Right, exactly. It's a good comparison.
Now let me ask you about what overshadowed the entire night. That was the incident between Ali Abdelaziz and Abraham Kawa, the two managers, two of the more notable managers. Of course, Ali, very notable, for better or worse. And he had an interesting week with that media day, which you were at in Los Angeles earlier in the week. There he is talking about, you know, wanting to change his stripes a little bit, be friendlier with everyone, be more positive, all this stuff. And then the first event that he's at, he allegedly strikes Abraham Kawa. And I thought that this was the main thing that people were talking about after what was a pretty entertaining night. Now, my understanding is you didn't actually see this, right? You reported on it, you spoke to the police, you spoke to some of the particulars, but you didn't actually see it, correct?
Correct. I didn't actually see it. I was only a few feet away because I was backstage, and it happened right, I guess, in the area right before you'd walk backstage from the crowd, you know, from the, almost like, you know, the ramp where the fighters were walking out. But I did not actually see it myself, no.
So why I bring this up is, of course, like, unless you're living under a rock, you are unaware of the ties between Ali and PFL, right? I mean, he used to work for World Series of Fighting, which was the organization that PFL became, and even this website, bodylockmma.com, Michael Fidel wrote a story about the connections that Ali has, and we know about his relationship with Ray Sefo, and it's very clear that there's a lot of Ali fighters, dominant MMA fighters, on the roster, and that's fine. He has the relationship. Cool. They've told us time and again that there's nothing more to it. They just have a good working relationship. He doesn't own the company. He doesn't have a financial stake. That's what they say. But something that you wrote in the piece stuck with me, especially coming off this incident with Abraham Kawa. And you said that Magomed Karimov was sick, and they wanted to go film in his locker room. And the quote that you had in your story was, "No camera," Magomed Karimov's manager Ali Abdelaziz said, "not now." In the UFC, a manager would never be allowed to tell the UFC cameras not to film someone backstage. And so that led me to believe that, like, he has a lot more power backstage and influence backstage than in other organizations where managers are backstage but certainly aren't telling the promotion what to do or what not to shoot. Did you get the sense, being backstage, that he is a lot more influential, that he has a lot more power than just your regular manager who has fighters on the card?
Honestly, no. I understand the question. I don't think that was so much the case. I think it was he wasn't backstage the entire night. He only came back because Magomed Karimov was sick and he was checking on his health. Otherwise, he was not there the entire night. He was not backstage. And it's I guess with the camera situation, it's really up to the fighters in the camps whether or not they want the cameras in their dressing areas, their locker areas while the fights are going on, because Kayla Harrison also, she had a closed locker room. She didn't let the cameras in pretty much the entire night. So I didn't go in her area at all. So I think it was more that situation than Ali. It didn't seem to me, you know, if I had no knowledge of any of the backstory, I wouldn't have thought that Ali Abdelaziz had any more power than anyone else backstage at PFL.
Okay, and what did you make of the statement that PFL gave you, right, about what happened? They said, quote, "We were focused on the action in the cage. We're going to look into the situation and see if we can find out anything about it." The action in the cage line from Jim Branson, who's their general counsel, and also the subsequent tweet from Ray Sefo to Abraham saying, like, you know, "It's not our fault that you got into this. We were focused on the cage," which he then took down. I felt like was a big misstep on their part. Like, it just seemed like they did not care that, like, of course you're focused on the action in the cage, but that doesn't mean that in broad daylight, out in the open in the VIP section, that you should just, you know, say, like, "Oh, I guess we missed that one." Like, you have two managers who are quarreling. This is not a good look for the company, in my opinion, especially given, you know, the insinuation that he has too much influence in the company.
Yeah, they sent me a new statement on Sunday, basically saying, mostly reiterating the same things, but also mentioning the names of the two managers and saying that they were continuing to look into it and seeing if there was any kind of action that they could take. I mean, it's just one of those situations. I don't know if the UFC would have done anything differently either in that spot. And they really, I mean, there was no one from PFL really around that area when it happened. So, like, there was no executive or anyone like that. It's a tough one. I don't know, especially like on right after the fights happened that night when everyone was there. I guess they didn't want to be too reactionary, but we'll see in the future if they do take any further action, and then we could possibly make a judgment upon them then if they don't.
Yeah, I was just hoping that they would condemn that sort of behavior.
Sure. I mean, yes.
which it didn't seem like they were doing so, and it made for, again, I felt like it made for a situation where that overshadowed the fights. That's what everyone was talking about on Saturday, when there were some good stories, to your point, like the David Michaud story. That's an amazing story. The guy gets knocked out in 17 seconds in the first fight, and now here he is fighting in the finale and has to drive there because he's afraid of flying from Arizona. That's amazing stuff. So great story. I suggest everyone check it out. It's on ESPN.com/MMA. Great insight into what goes on backstage, especially at one of these playoff events. Want to talk to you about what you reported on yesterday. You were at the CSAC, California State Athletic Commission hearing in downtown Los Angeles. First, let me ask you about the Aspen Ladd story. So she appeals her loss to Jermaine Durandamy on the basis of gender discrimination, and she ends up losing the appeal 3-2. A, were you surprised that she lost? And B, were you surprised that two people voted in favor of reversing the call?
I wasn't surprised that she lost the appeal because, and you know this, Ariel, so few of these appeals actually work out. I mean, I can only think of like maybe one in recent memory that has worked out where a fighter went to a commission, appealed the result of a fight, and it got overturned to a no contest. So in that regard, no, I was not surprised. I was surprised by the two votes in the affirmative for that, and I was surprised by gender discrimination being the, I guess, one of the arguments made. And I've spoken to Aspen and her team, you know, since then, and it seems like they felt like they didn't really want to go overboard with the gender discrimination thing. It was something that was mentioned over the course of the appeal, but they didn't feel like that was their main argument, their main claim. They just felt like Herb Dean stopped the fight too quickly. So that they felt like, I guess, like they mentioned it in the hearing and then the commission kind of ran with it from there, whereas it wasn't really the crux of her argument. But I mean, yeah, I was a bit surprised. I think it's safe to say that 49 other states, there probably wouldn't have been any votes to overturn that result. But California is a different kind of state. It's a very left-leaning state politically.
Interesting. Okay. So I wasn't expecting – so do we know the identity of the two people who voted in favor of reversing it? Like, were they females?
Yes. The two people who voted in favor of overturning they voted – the motion was to uphold Herb Dean's call. So the two people who voted to not uphold the call were CSAC Vice Chairman Mary Lehman and Commissioner Martha Shen Urquidez, who, if you remember, was the commissioner. She's a lawyer. She was the one who grilled John Jones a couple of years ago during his CSAC hearing.
And so, like, this brought up this whole conversation, and it's been happening. Alex Davis, the manager, has been very vocal about this. Others have as well.
He's appealing everything.
He's appealing everything.
Appealing everything.
He's appealing fights that he won because
Correct.
He didn't like one scorecard. And my question to him was like, okay, so if you're on the opposite end of a gift decision, like basically if you are getting a gift decision, right, and you didn't deserve to win, your fighter didn't deserve to win, are you going to appeal that as well? Something tells me you won't. I'm not trying to say that his intentions are disingenuous, but what I'm trying to say is like these appeals seem frivolous. Like very rarely, if ever, do they happen. Everyone talks about the one, the Tania Evinger, Yana Kunitskaya one, which
Correct.
Is valid. Can you name another? Like off the top of your head, can you name another successful appeal in the history of North American MMA? I can't.
No, that was the one that I thought of when I just said that I can think of one. It was the one in Missouri with Tania Evinger and Skaya. Can't think of another one. And I kind of get what Alex Davis is saying. I mean, he wants there to be some accountability.
Yes,
he wants these commissions to have to answer for the decisions they make. He doesn't want it to be just shrouded in mystery. He wants them to answer for it. So I kind of get that. But I doesn't necessarily mean that these are going to work. And I think he knows they're not going to work, but I guess he just wants them to have to, you know, actually speak about why they do the things they do.
So my retort is, why don't we worry about trying to make the judging and officiating better beforehand? Like before, like, why don't we pay them more, invest in more, teach them more, right? Like, let's be a little proactive as opposed to, you know, complaining after the fact, because clearly these appeals are bogus. They're empty. Nothing ever happens. It's all this like, you know, dog and pony show. So that, I mean, I'm not surprised that they didn't vote in favor of reversing the call. I thought that there was no chance that was going to happen. It wasn't even all that controversial, if we're being honest. But hey, you know, I if they want to try, sure. It costs some money though, right? Doesn't it cost some money to actually go through with this? A little bit?
It does.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it does. Certainly. I think, to your point, Ariel, I think, I mean, the whole commission system, I think, is flawed.
Yes.
From the very start. I mean, the fact that they're, you know, the UFC is this multi-billion dollar organization, and there's all these, you know, fantastic world-class fighters on the roster. And they're being sanctioned, regulated by this kind of like makeshift group of commissions. There's one in every state, every province in Canada. They all have, you know, in some cases, different rules, different bylaws, different policies. You know, the judges are underpaid. They have, you know, they have other jobs outside of judging. The referees are underpaid. I mean, it's just like it seems like the balance is wrong here because of the money that the UFC has and the fighters, the quality of the fighters and the need for health and safety, and then what we have on the regulatory side. And I don't know whose fault that is. It's really no one's fault. It's just the way that it's always been done with boxing and combat sports. But it's 2019. You know, there needs to be, to me, there needs to be a national commission.
Couldn't agree more, 100%. I don't know if that'll ever happen, but I couldn't agree more with that. Now, California, and in particular Andy Foster, their executive director, has been very eager and willing and has worked hard to try and combat extreme weight cutting. Could you tell us about this rule that they passed and what they're trying to do to combat this? Pardon the pun.
Yeah, so the rule that was voted on yesterday and approved by the California Commission was on a weigh-in on fight day. So that there's a regular weigh-in, the official weigh-in on Fridays or the day before the fight. That's going to go on as normal. There will be a second weigh-in the day of the fight, which they have been doing anyway. They've been tracking these weights on the second day. On that fight day weigh-in, if a fighter is above 15% over the contracted weight class, the fight will be canceled. That's pretty much – that's the rule that was passed. Now, it's not going to go into effect immediately. It's one of these rules that has to actually be written into the California legislature. So it's going to take about a year for it to actually go through and become official and be put forth in practice. But beginning whenever that rule goes into effect, UFC fight, Bellator fight, whatever fight, if on fight day a fighter is above 15% over their weight class, the fight will not go on.
Wow.
That will be written into the California state laws.
What are the chances other commissions adopt this as well?
I would say off the bat, not many will do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's risky. It's
right.
Very risky.
Yeah, of course.
Because California is in a position where MMA is not their bread and butter. Boxing, I think, probably makes California more money by far than MMA. I think it's like, I want to say it's like 65-35 or maybe 60-40. It's really more of a boxing state. The UFC is not even in their top three biggest promoters in the state. As far as combat sports, so they have a little bit of leverage. Whereas a lot of states want the UFC to come because they need it for their revenue. You know, a lot of the commissions are self financed, and they need the revenue from UFC fights to even stay alive.
Mm.
So California is in a unique position where they don't really like they don't need the UFC to come there. They'll function fine without the UFC or without Bellator. So they're in a position, I guess, of some leverage. So I think that's why they've been able to make some of these more, sweeping rule changes.
Absolutely fascinating. If you want to learn more about this, the weight cutting rule, if you want to learn more about the Aspen Ladd failed appeal, again, the PFL story, go to ESPN.com/MMA right now. Mark was all over it this past couple of days. Thank you very much for doing this, Mark. And once again, I just want to commend you on the fantastic audio quality.
Why, thank you very much. You should thank Troy for that.
Yes, thank you, Troy.
He's the mastermind behind it all.
All right. Thank you very much, Mark and TST. Before we move along to our next guest, two things I need to tell you about. Why two things? Because TST makes me do this. Cracking the whip. First, let me tell you about my good friends over at the Behind the Bets podcast. If you are a fan of gambling, sports gambling, all those things that go into sports gambling, people talk about lines, all this stuff, over under. I don't know anything about this stuff, but I know that these guys are the best when it comes to sports gambling, especially football. They got a great podcast. My guy, Doug Kazarian, he holds it down, host of the Daily Wager. The pod is called Behind the Bets, and you can find it wherever you get your podcast. Do me a favor, download it. Show them some love. Also, let me tell you about my good friends over at Dollar Shave Club. These guys are the best. One of my favorite sponsors ever. You know I have a beard, right? You see it. You love it. You're envious of it. That's what TST told me. He wishes he can grow a beard like this. In any event, it's not just a beard. There's a lot that goes into said beard. You can't just like walk out of your house with a beard. You gotta clean it up, clean up the neck, shave it. Clean up top. I mean, there's a whole process. And when I do this, I use all things Dollar Shave Club. When I talk about Dollar Shave Club, I can't stress enough the quality of their products. That, to me, is number one. They've spent years developing, crafting, refining, everything. They have everything I use to look, feel, and smell my best. You name it, they have it, and I use it. I've been a Dollar Shave Club member for years, approximately 5 to 6. They were a sponsor back in the old MMA Hour days. And as amazing as their shave stuff is, Dollar Shave Club is way more than just razors. You think it's just razors? Dollar Shave Club has you covered head to toe. They have everything you need to shower, shave, style your hair, brush your teeth, and more. And Dollar Shave Club can keep you automatically stocked up on the products you use. You get what you want whenever you need it, whether that's once a month or a few times a year. I never have to waste time at a store wondering if what I'm getting is any good. And as a Dollar Shave Club member, I know what I'm getting is the highest quality. And right now, you can put the quality of Dollar Shave Club's product to the test with their Ultimate Shave Starter Set. It has basically everything you need for an amazing shave. The Executive Razor, Shave Butter, Prep Scrub, and Post Shave Do. The best part is, you can try it for just $5. After that, restock box ships regular size products at regular prices. Get your Ultimate Starter Set for just $5 at dollarshaveclub.com/Helwani. That's dollarshaveclub.com/HELWANI. Love these people. Support them because they support us. Now, let us move along. Kill the music, TST. All right? We got a very important guest coming up. In my opinion, he is pound for pound the best boxing writer in the world. His features are phenomenal. In fact, in the last week, he's written 3 incredible features. One about Tyson Fury and his venture into the world of pro wrestling. Another about George St. Pierre and Artur Beterbiev, who's a protege of his. GSP has been sort of a mentor, up-and-coming boxer, undefeated boxer. And unfortunately, about Patrick Day, who's a boxer who's currently fighting for his life. And this has become, unfortunately, a common story over the past couple of months in the sport of boxing. That one just came out today, Wednesday morning, and it was heartbreaking to read. It was phenomenal work. He also works at the NFL Network. He's a voice on the Top Rank on ESPN broadcasts. He's prolific. He's one of a kind. He's an amazing writer, and it's a huge honor to have Mark Kriegel on the program. And first off, Mark, thank you very much for joining us. And I want to start with the GSP story. You had the opportunity to sit down with GSP and his protege in Montreal recently over what appeared to be a beautiful lunch. I want to know more about the lunch in a bit. But first off, I just wanted to know if that was the first time that you met GSP in person and what your impressions of him were. I think he's the greatest fighter of all time, at least in MMA. I wanted to know what you thought of him.
First time I sat down with GSP, I'm trying to think if I ever met him at the Wild Card. I know that he worked on his striking with Freddie Roach here in Los Angeles. But to my knowledge, unless I'm really punch drunk, it was the first time I sat down with him, and he was great. Really what I was taking with was his fellowship toward other fighters. I mean, it's something that I asked you about before I left for Montreal. By the way, I mean, Montreal is a great fight city. Wrestling, boxing, MMA. But Beterbiev is a deeply religious guy. He's Chechen. He's from a culture that doesn't tolerate too much talking or outspokenness or big talk. GSP's from Montreal. It's a much more open society. And, you know, at first glance, they're really different kinds of guys, but they're bound by this fellowship that all fighters have, whether it's their MMA fighters or boxers or kickboxers or whatever they are. And GSP was the guy who acknowledged that. And he saw something in Beterbiev. He admired the guy's ferocious in the ring. He's enormously powerful. He's relentless. But when he got to Montreal, he was also alone. and without much guidance. So GSP, there was some problems with his contract, with his management, and GSP made his resources available to Beterbiev. And he didn't know the guy from Adam, and he didn't owe him anything, but he recognized something that was kindred, that all fighters have. And I think that when you get right down to it, there's an acknowledgement that we all risk our lives, and it's a dirty business, but we do it anyway.
And so do they actually train together, or is he just sort of mentoring him with the management stuff and all that?
They'll do a little working out.
Okay.
But they have never sparred.
Okay.
They will never spar.
Why not?
And they don't spar, but he saw something in him. I mean, what I found most striking was George's description of Beterbiev's style. He's pretty efficient, but he's very relentless, and he cuts off the ring until you have nowhere to go, and the opponent starts to feel some panic. And you know, GSP saw this immediately, even though it's not his discipline. It's something that's relentless and constraining and constricting. And before you've even, if Beterbiev is working as he should, before you've even taken a punch, you're exhausted from the mental strain this puts on you, you know, the anticipation of it. And he's fighting, I mean, he's got another undefeated champion on Friday night, also from Russia, from the former Soviet Union. They fought as amateurs. The four light heavyweight champions in professional boxing now all come from Russia. Kovalev, Bivol, Bozdik, and Beterbiev, both of whom fight on Friday. But of that whole crew, Beterbiev was the most feared. And he beat Kovalev enough times that Kovalev said, "The hell with it, I'm going to the States," where he made a pretty good score over the years.
When you were sitting down with George St. Pierre, obviously he's a very fit guy, and these days a lot has been made of the fact that he's slimmer, he's doing a lot of fasting, and people want to see him, or I've been talking about him versus Khabib Nurmagomedov, and the UFC said no to that fight, and you asked him about the state of his career and the retirement back in February and all that. When you were sitting, looking at that guy and talking to that guy, was that a retired fighter, or was that a businessman who made this announcement but was just trying to play, you know, a certain game with the UFC and eventually will come back? You've been around the fight game a long time. Is that a guy who is done fighting?
I don't think so. I got a good sense of him. It doesn't mean he has to fight. But I asked him, I said, "Archer, is your friend here? Is he retired?" He looked at me and was kind of cute. He says, like, "Yeah, nah, I don't think so." And I think that, that there's some draw that's attraction to the game, that's good business. But ultimately, I think to fight that well in front of so many people, to be that good, to be great, requires a kind of ego that you just can't put it out, man. You know, the same thing that makes you great, it takes an enormous ego to get in the damn ring. It takes a gargantuan ego to be great. And you can't just snuff that out. The same thing that made you great or made you a fighter makes it impossible to go away, because you're always thinking, like, well, what if? And I don't think GSP isn't fighting for the money, but he is fighting for posterity. He is fighting for his reputation, if not right now, in 5 years from now, in 10 years from now. Do I really want Khabib to go off into the sunset as the undefeated MMA fighter when I'm recognized now as the greatest? And I don't mean to tell you about your sport, but I do think there's this sort of existential ego question there, and that's a lot of what propels guys into the ring and then back into the ring. Besides that, it's a hell of a lot of money. I mean, with Mayweather fighting Mayweather fighting McGregor, I think it was, you know, there was an obvious, huge mercenary motive. I think that would be part of it here. How do you turn down the money? And I think that guys use the money as a measure of their ego, a measure of their standing, as well they should. But it's that opportunity to make history. I don't think that you can ever say you're done, and nor did GSP. And if the deal was right, I'd come back. And I mean, you know, I'm looking on Twitter. I can't imagine it's a fight most people would complain about, or many people would complain about.
I understand this is a very broad question, but I'm just curious to hear your answer. If I would ask you, what are the biggest differences, or what's the biggest difference between boxing and mixed martial arts? Obviously, I know about the sport and those differences, but like as far as like the state of those two sports and how they fit in the fight game, what jumps out at you? What's the biggest difference?
First, I just want to say one thing, because I went to TriStar and I watched ESP workout, and I can't believe how many forms of martial arts you need high level of competence in. It's extraordinary.
Yeah.
But to me, the biggest difference is the undefeated record. The way that boxing has evolved, a lot of it in this century through Mayweather, fighters or promoters or networks figure, oh my God, if you have a loss, you suck, you're done, you're finished, you're over. And in point of fact, your career doesn't begin to become a dramatic proposition until you have lost. And, you know, when you were sort of straightening me out on GSP, you broke his career down into, I think it was before and after Matt Serra.
Yep.
And you winning every time out can be goddamn boring. The most dramatic fight is a dramatic construct. Nothing beats, okay, you've gotten your ass kicked. Now what are you going to do? Ali did it. Pacquiao did it. Ray Leonard did it. Mayweather didn't do it. And perhaps that was because he was so good. Perhaps because it was a fundamentally cautious style. I don't know. But we were lacking in some drama there. You know, you need a real antagonist to bring out the story. And ultimately, what we're doing, whether it's MMA or boxing or whatever combat sport you want to talk about, ultimately what the media is doing, and I don't mean to be cynical here, but it's the purest exercise in storytelling there is. And it's why wrestling works. And no one really gives a damn whether it's fake or not, because it's a fairly pure exercise in storytelling.
So I couldn't agree more with that. Losses don't mean as much in mixed martial arts. Some of the best fighters of all time have double-digit losses on their record. I mean, Nate Diaz and Jorge Masvidal are about to sell out Madison Square Garden next month, and both of them have double-digit losses on their record, and they're in the main event. And double-digit loss in boxing, like, you're a journeyman. And so I couldn't agree more. You're a total bum.
You look down box record, you go, oh, my God, he's got 11 losses. He's a piece of garbage. No way. We can't do it.
Yep.
So, and again, all these great fighters had losses. You know, Marciano, you know, died in an airplane crash, was an anomaly. But I think that there is way too much made in boxing, and it really hurts the sport in preserving the zero and the idea of a loss as a catastrophic event. The first big fight I covered in Vegas, you know, the columnist for the New York Post, like 1992, was Bo Holyfield 1. And to that point, Evander Holyfield was regarded as a blown-up light heavyweight, a blown-up cruiserweight. He was boring. He just wasn't that good. He wasn't Tyson. He wasn't Ali. He was nothing. And then he stood up to Riddick Bowe in a majestic fight. And he lost. And he became bigger in defeat than he had ever been in victory. And that was where, as far as the public is concerned, and again, it's an exercise in storytelling, That's where he made his bones. That's where he made his reputation. No one could take that away from him. And it didn't matter if it was a defeat or not. You know? Joe Frazier lost the Thriller in Manila. Okay, because does that diminish him, really? Or I don't know. He won the first one. It's just you get to the point where Mayweather-Pacquiao, I'll give you an example. Mayweather-Pacquiao took more time to make than it took Ali and Frazier to stage their trilogy. And that's the kind of – that's where MMA succeeds and boxing fails. Now maybe it's not an entirely fair comparison because there's one great league or one supreme league and that league has more power. But still, you know, I mean, there's too many guys, too many entities are protecting zero. And that's what screws things up, in my estimation.
Another thing that I would have brought up is there is a culture in the sport of boxing, in the rich history of boxing, of sort of living to fight another day. Throwing in the towel isn't common in our sport. I mean, I could count maybe three off the top of my head situations where someone threw in the towel or a corner stopped the fight. In boxing, you see it a lot more often. However, this has not been a great stretch for boxing and the health of boxers. We recall back in August, two deaths in the span of a week, Maxime Dadashev and Hugo Alfredo Santillan. And now it seems as though Patrick Day, you wrote a heartbreaking story. I mean, it's phenomenal journalism, it was phenomenal writing, but it pains you to read these quotes about the state of his life and his trainer and how he feels about boxing. It reminds me a little bit of Howard Cosell, who towards the end of his life sort of turned on boxing because he felt like it was too barbaric. And so I'm wondering, like, when you see this, how do you reconcile this as a journalist? How do you? I believe you were there when Maxime died, right? You were at that fight.
Yeah, I was there. I was there.
Isn't it hard?
If you read the column this morning, the trainer Joe Higgins, trainer of Pat Day, and Joe wasn't on the hustle. He wasn't doing this for the money. He was a retired firefighter, and he had been pretty damaged. 9/11, he was a first responder. He lost his brother, and he lived in Freeport, Long Island. I mean, excuse me for seeing far afield here, but
no problem.
He had a heavy bag hanging in his garage, and a kid from across the street came in. Patrick Day started tapping the bag. He's 14 years old, and Joe says, "Hey, you know, you always walk into people's houses uninvited," and of course, that's why he was hanging the damn bag there. So Joe Higgins goes to Pat Day's mother, let him fight. She doesn't want to do it. She's very religious. She's a translator at the UN. The kid's father's a doctor. He's not some fighting stock. But he keeps coming to the gym. And Joe Higgins' wife says to him, you know, every time that kid from across the street, you see him, you get better. So Pat Day healed Higgins in large measure. And then he turned the kid pro. He wasn't doing it for the money. They thought that they had a mission. This was pure. This was good. And Higgins didn't throw in the towel. And now he shuttered his gym. He told his kids and his assistant to go back home while Pat Day lay in the hospital in Chicago and shuttered the gym. He goes, I don't want anyone hitting the heavy bag that Pat hit. I don't want anyone in the ring that he was in last. I'm never going to watch another boxing match. I'm done with this. Maybe I'll work for the church. I don't know. Point is, maybe he's asking himself if I should have thrown in the towel. There's no real indication. It wasn't like a one-sided garbage fight where a guy was just taking a beating. I don't have a real answer for you, but he says he's never going to watch another fight again. My friend Lou DiBella, Day's promoter, said it's very difficult to justify this sport. And for the first time, I feel really personally, I write stories about fighters, and more often than not, it's about the dysfunction or the challenges in the interior of their lives. And I feel like garbage. I do. I mean, sometimes I wonder what the hell, you know, what, why are you writing about this? I don't have a good answer for you, but I don't have a good answer for you. I really don't. I wish I did.
And I appreciate that. I appreciate that very much. I can't imagine it not be. I mean, you witness someone dying, and that it's
Dadashev was a different case. Dadashev and his trainer Buddy McGirt came together later in life, and I thought McGirt acted heroically. That was I wasn't there the other night in Chicago. It wasn't our car. Dadashev was. And it became clear as the fight went on that that it was becoming one-sided. And Buddy McGirt, I did a column on it, you can look it up, and Buddy McGirt pleaded with Dadashev to stop the fight. So it goes to your point about throwing in a towel. There's an exchange, I guess it was after the 10th round. So he goes, Max, please, please, I'm going to stop it, please. And what Buddy McGirt was asking for was his fighter's blessing. Throw in the towel. Please let me throw in the towel so it's no shame for you. And Dadashev heard, you could see him in his last conscious moments. He heard him, and he would not let him do it. He wouldn't give him his blessing to throw in the towel. So it wouldn't have made a damn bit of difference anyway. It was over, and Buddy stopped the fight. And you didn't know how wrong everything was until Dadashev tried to get out of the ring, and he couldn't make it on his own power. And then he started throwing up. I've never seen anything like that. I've been covering the game for a long time. I'd never seen anything like that. But the culture of throwing in the towel, you can argue that there should be more throwing in the towel, but it doesn't help. I mean, you know, the best of these guys, we're talking before about GSP and the ego required to actually do this for a living and to get in front of in front of an entire world, basically naked, exposed, how much ego that requires. But it also means that the flip side of that is you have so much ego, you're kind of cursed with your own courage. And that's where the fighter has to be protected from himself. Now, I look at the Dadashev fight, and I look at the Pat Day fight. You can't say that the trainers were scales or they were, like, exploiting the fighter. You can't say it about, you know, DiBello, the promoter. He really cared for this kid. Really did. I just got off the phone with him. I don't have an answer. It's why I feel so crappy about it. I don't have an answer.
I think if you didn't feel crappy about it, that would be weird. Like I wasn't really expecting you to have an answer. It's just a hard, I think about it. We've never had a serious death in the UFC. I've never witnessed a serious death or in Bellator or a major promotion. There have been a few, but never on like the main stage, if you will. And I am like the week of those two deaths, I went to cover a fight in Edmonton and I felt weird about it. To me, it's all the same. It's all the fight game. These are all fighters. You can interchange all these guys. And I often think about, you know, what exactly are we doing, or how can we change this, or can we do anything to change this? I don't have an answer for that either. I was just wondering if you battled with the same emotions and feelings as I was feeling. And when I read your story about Pat Day this morning, it broke my heart. I want nothing to do with this. I don't want to watch a fight, let alone cover one.
Yeah, but you know, there's something. I don't know if it's all of us, but there's something in a lot of us that will watch and will pay money to see one person fight another person.
Sure.
Now, as a what makes for any dramatic construct is conflict. And the two institutions I know of that create conflict naturally are boxing or MMA. And I'm not making any distinction. Fighting sports and families. I don't know if you have this in MMA, but what we have in boxing is, I hesitate to call it an epidemic, but I've never seen more kids trained by their dads. I don't, and I think it, I don't know what the hell it has to do with. Maybe it's an expression of the ego. Maybe it has to do with the old neighborhood gym is closed down. It's a bunch of things. But boxing and families, or fighting sports and families, that's a recipe for, you know, it's good for what I do. It's the reason why the boxing is so prominent as cinema, and far less prominent as a sport. I'm not even sure boxing is a sport. I don't know what the hell it is. But I know that people will watch it despite all of our moralizing. Maybe it's more satisfying and easier to walk away when it is wrestling. When the conflict may be athletic but choreographed, so that no one really gets that damaged. Well, if you look at the history of wrestling, I don't know if you can make that argument either. But what one of the questions I have, and I don't know if there's any answer, why are boxing deaths more frequent than MMA deaths? Is it the nature of the blow? You know, you don't have submissions. I don't know. Is it the repeated blow? Is it sparring? I don't know.
I can't tell you how big of a fan I am of your work, not only on .com, but on television as well, on the Top Rank broadcasts. In addition to those two stories, you wrote a great story following Tyson Fury at his recent, you know, wrestling appearances, and I really enjoyed that as well. You continue to do great work and raise the bar, Mark. I really appreciate you doing this. By the way, last thing, what was the name of that restaurant in Montreal? Do you remember? Was it Arthur's?
I got to tell you, I'm not shilling here. The restaurant was effing great.
Was it Arthur's?
No. Mon Lapin.
Oh, okay. I don't know that
Mon
one.
Mon Lapin, 150 Saint Zotique.
Wow.
Van Mon Lapin. It was really good. I mean, because I like to eat.
Yes.
They put the food down in front of us as we're doing the conversation. And it's really hard for me not to eat. You know, you don't want like a piece of fish in your,
right.
You don't want to look funky while you're doing the TV piece. But anyway,
it was great.
Maybe we'll do this again. It'll be less emotional.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it very much. Thank you, Mark.
Take care, buddy. Thank you. Bye-bye.
There he is, Mark Kriegel of ESPN.com and the NFL Network and ESPN Television. Just phenomenal. And I really appreciate his insight and his emotion talking about that, because I sympathize with it. I feel the same thing, and he's a lot closer to that because he's covering boxing. We haven't had to deal with it stateside as much, but it's almost like I'm just waiting for it to happen, because it feels like at some point something's going to happen, because it just does in the fight game. So let's transition from that to the 30 for 30 documentary that I told you about at the top of the show, Chuck and Tito. It aired last night. If you're an ESPN Plus subscriber and you missed it, it will be on ESPN Plus beginning Friday, October 18th. So that's just in a couple of days. TST, can we play a little trailer of this for those that may have missed it?
To sell a fight, what you really need is you need conflict. And there was nothing but conflict with me, Tito, and Chuck.
When the Fertitta brothers and Dana White took over the UFC, they had to rebrand the entire organization.
Banned in North Carolina.
There were a lot of states you couldn't hold fights, and people thought it was fight to the death.
Tito and Chuck ushered in the era where people outside this hardcore niche were beginning to pay attention to mixed martial arts.
Here's this young kind of Gen X kid as a potential hero, or someone they want to see get their ass kicked because he talks so much crap.
Who's the champ now, partner?
At the same time Tito was winning, Chuck was winning.
Yeah, that was Chuck Liddell. He was a marauder. He was a different kind of cat.
All of us were friends. We fought on the same team together.
It was obvious that they were going to fight.
One of your best friends, Chuck Liddell, is next in line. What's going to happen?
Me and Chuck, I mean, our friendship's not worth the money we're getting paid, if you ask me.
He didn't want to fight me because he knew what was going to happen.
Tito was just trying to hold on to that belt for as long as he could.
It was never Tito Ortiz versus Chuck Liddell. It was them against me.
And Chuck Liddell is the light heavyweight champion!
They carry the sport into the modern era.
I'm gonna knock him out, and he knows it.
And he
It was a real life soap opera and the dissolution of a friendship over money, fame, and how do they settle it? In the cage.
Pleasure to be joined by the director of that film, Micah Brown, who's kind enough to join us a day after it aired on ESPN. Micah, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing? Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you very much. And thanks for including me in the documentary. I enjoyed it very much. I enjoyed watching it yesterday. It was a nice trip down memory lane. It got me all nostalgic about the good old days of the sport and the UFC and the rivalry and how it helped build the sport and the UFC in particular. Let me ask you this. How did you even get involved in this? Was it your idea? Did you pitch it to them? How did it all start? How did it get born?
Yeah, so I was sitting around with Jose Morales, who works at ESPN, and him and I were thinking about, you know, what idea can we do together? And I was like, man, I would love to make a UFC documentary. They haven't done a UFC film yet for 30 for 30. And so I started looking at different ideas of, you know, who are the guys that could help establish, you know, the early days of the UFC and how much the sport grew. And clearly Chuck and Tito were the two godfathers of this, and so we just were off and running from there.
Now, when you came up with the idea, was it because they were about to fight? Like, was the documentary supposed to be about the third fight and then it turned into something else?
Yeah, I think initially, you know, what sparked my interest was, you know, these two guys who are legends, all of a sudden they announced that they're going to fight again, and I was like, oh, man. You know, my background is kind of doing more follow documentaries, and so initially I was like, ah, yeah, let's follow them all the way up to their third fight and kind of make that the main thing and weave in and out of, you know, this A story of their origin. But, you know, as the creative process went along, you know, we kind of had to focus it more linear than that and just kind of bookend it with this fight instead of having it be all about the follow stuff. And I'm really proud with how it turned out.
And so when you approached them about doing this doc, about doing the story, were they both on board right away? I mean, I would imagine they're honored that ESPN wants to do a 30 for 30, but were there any reservations? Did you have to convince them to do it?
You know, I actually didn't know either fighter at that time. Brett Okamoto knew them, and he was a producer on the film as well. And so he reached out to their managers, and their managers literally texted back in, you know, 5 minutes, and they're like, yeah, let's do this. And so there was no reservations. You know, I told them both that I wanted to honor them, and that was my main goal, is to show that both of them helped build this sport to what it is today, and I think that we accomplished that.
When you were – so you guys were backstage at the third fight, and to me the third fight almost kind of ruins the rivalry in a sense that, like, the two first fights were so good and were so important, and the buzz was just amazing, especially the second fight. UFC 66 was just incredible. And the third fight kind of soils – the first two in a weird way, but I understand that you can kind of separate the two entities, right? You can keep the first two and leave it pretty far away from the third. But I'm just wondering, being there at the third fight, I wasn't there in person. I certainly watched it from home. Like, were you depressed being there? Because that was a depressing scene on television. Like, the whole buildup was kind of depressing. De La Hoya was depressing. Everything was depressing. And then the fight itself ended very depressing in the sense that, like, Chuck just didn't look like himself. What was it like actually being there?
You know, I think what was actually surprising about it was the spectacle was actually really cool in person. You know, I think that all of us were a little bit worried, you know, because we didn't know how it was going to turn out and if Chuck, how bad it was going to be, if Chuck was going to win, or if he was going to get beat badly. You know, ultimately, like, what we had feared the most ended up happening. But I don't know that I was depressed going into it, because I think that, you know, being around Chuck during his training camp and everything like that, you saw some flashes. You know, I think, you know, Golden Boy put out some stuff of showing him, and his punches weren't very hard and his kicks weren't very hard. But, you know, you saw some flashes, and you didn't really know on the flip side how Tito was going to handle some of that stuff, you know. And so for me, what was interesting about the third fight, it was more about the fact that they were changing the business model. And I thought that was really interesting, because here you had Tito always saying that this is the model that they should have always had. And then you had Chuck Liddell actually accepting that fact as well and almost agreeing with it, which was something that, as the company man, he really hadn't done in the past, which is what I thought was the most interesting of it, more than thinking it was sad.
And then the big question, of course, is, like, you know, the UFC historically They're not easy to work with when it comes to documentaries. I've talked to a lot of documentarians who have told me that, you know, they don't want to give footage or they only give you a little bit, things like that. Of course, they're very much involved in this and it's a glowing piece for the most part in the sense that it talks about the rise of the company along with the rise of that rivalry, and Dana White's a prominent figure in the story as he should be. But what was it like working with them, and when you reached out to them, were they open to being a part of this?
You know, I actually didn't really have any direct engagement with the UFC, which was kind of nice for me as a filmmaker. I could kind of just sit back and worry about the story. That kind of went through all of the ESPN channels, and they managed that relationship. As far as working with Dana White, you know, I had an opportunity to go and be a part of his interview, and he was gracious enough to give us a long interview. And, you know, I think that he understood the vision, and ultimately we came out with a product that the UFC and ESPN were both really proud of.
How would you describe the state of the relationship between Chuck and Dana now?
I don't want to speak for Chuck. I think that's probably a better question, you know, for him. I don't know about his personal relationship with Dana. I know that, you know, he was let go from the UFC, and that had to sting. You know, because I think in Chuck's mind, he was promised a, you know, lifetime position for what he'd done to help grow the sport. And so, you know, I could see that probably is, you know, causes a little bit of friction. But, you know, I don't know as far as where their friendship is. That would be a question for Chuck.
On the flip side, it doesn't seem like the hatchet has been buried between Dana and Tito. And at times, like, there was, like, some personal insults, which, you know, if I'm being honest, like, my one gripe of the whole film was that it just felt like it got too personal at times, like calling Tito dumb and all that stuff. Like, it just didn't seem necessary. And as a fan, there's a part of me that wishes that the hatchet would be buried and they can all just kind of recognize that they were all good for each other. And at the very end, Dana does recognize that, it seems, where he says that, like, they helped grow the sport, the rivalry helped grow the sport, and Tito needs Chuck and Chuck needs Tito. But do you get the sense from Tito's end? Because that's the sense that I get when I speak to him, that, like, he would like for this to be over. He wants to bury the hatchet. He doesn't like being in this feud, and yet for some reason it hasn't happened that way. Do you get that sense as well?
Yeah, you know, I think Tito has tried to bury the hatchet with both people. You know, honestly, I think the hard thing is that once the damage is done, you know, especially with fighters in the fight game, it doesn't seem like forgiveness is like a really big character trait that too many people have. I can't speak to whether that's warranted or not, but, you know, in talking with Tito personally, yeah, he says he would be cool with Dana, you know, if Dana would just give him respect back. And so I think that that's kind of the one thing, is that it goes both ways. You can't call somebody stupid and a dummy, you know, 15 times in the course of a film and expect somebody to be cool to you in return. You know, it just doesn't work. And so I think it takes maturity from both sides in order to mend a relationship. And I don't know that Dana or Tito is necessarily in that kind of place in their maturity to be able to make that happen.
When it initially aired in late September, Tito was very vocal online saying that it wasn't accurate and he didn't like the final version of the film and all that stuff. Did you see those comments and were you at all bothered by them?
Yeah, I saw them. You know, I think it's always kind of hard to know that somebody is, you know, disappointed in the way that things, you know, turn out. I think whenever you're going through a documentary process, you know, there's a lot of people that chime in on notes. You know, you have your internal notes. You have your ESPN notes. ESPN has a relationship with the UFC. They get their notes. And, you know, as a director, sometimes you're not going to get all the things that you fight for. And sometimes, you know, things just change. I'm not the first director to have to answer to notes, and I won't be the last. I mean, that's just kind of the part of you know, the documentary making project or process. And, you know, for me, you know, we're also balancing three pretty big perspectives, Chuck, Tito, and Dana. And, you know, some perspective is not going to be happy. It's impossible to please everybody. But what I will say, to Tito's credit, even though Tito had that initial blast of the film, you know, when it first came out, since then, he has kind of changed his tune, and I have had a chance to talk to him numerous times, and he's really proud of the way that it came out, and he's even been very, very vocal in saying that he's proud of the film, he's appreciative of the film, and I think he really likes it.
That is great to hear. Anything surprise you that you weren't expecting in the process of making this film, something that you learned that you didn't know about that just really stands out as, wow, I didn't think that would happen, or I didn't know about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest shocker to me was finding out the depths of Chuck Liddell's family life. You know, I don't think anybody had ever known. Everybody knew about his grandpa and what role his grandpa played in his life, but never got the story about his birth father abusing his mother and kind of the depth of that pain and his father trying to come back into his life and all of those things. And so, you know, when we discovered that story, I had sat down with Chuck before we did the interview, and I had said, hey, if you want this to be special, just be unfiltered and just be real. Don't censor yourself. Don't try to, like, say anything. Like, people want to know the real Chuck Liddell. This is your opportunity to tell the real Chuck Liddell. And he was like, absolutely, let's do this. And within a half hour, we heard that story, and I was like, man, this is going to be something different and something special.
Wow. I understand you saw him last week at the premiere in Los Angeles, correct?
Yeah. He looked pretty banged up.
Yeah, I saw some tweets that he's walking with a cane now. He had some kind of surgery recently.
Yeah, he had a partial knee replacement, and then he also had surgery on his spine.
Oh, wow.
To repair some discs that were blown out. So, I mean, this will tell you something about Chuck Liddell now. Chuck Liddell is a tough dude, because the night before, I believe, he had that partial knee replacement, and then the previous week, he had surgery to repair those discs in his spine. And, wow. You know, Chuck had told me that when he went in to fight Tito, he actually had that spine issue, and he didn't know about it. And he had gone in and fought anyway. And when he went into the doctor, he said if he kept his eyes closed for too long, he would fall over. And he couldn't walk in a straight line, like heel to toe. And so that's why his balance looked off and everything. And, you know, he just thought that it was getting older, hadn't been in camp. Man, he had a blown out discs or whatever in his spine. And they said if he would have gotten body slammed in that fight, he would have been a paraplegic.
Jeez.
You know, and so that tells you the kind of warrior that Chuck is, that, man, he had an injury that most people would have sat out on, but he was committed to doing something. He didn't pull out of a fight. He went out there and fought. And I think that, you know, some people may see that as really dumb. I see it as kind of like, well, what do you expect from anything less from Chuck Liddell? I mean, that's the kind of guy he is. And he actually told me last week that he's retired for good.
Oh, you know? Okay.
So that was kind of a breaking thing.
Interesting. So because I'm not giving anything away for those that listen to this show, like, he's kind of left it open, but he has told you, you know, and you kind of leave it open at the end of the film, but he's told you definitively he's done?
Well, he said when we were on the Adam Carolla show, he said that he's retired.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, I guess that's good news. I thought the fight was depressing. Could you imagine if the scenario you just talked about actually happened? That would have been tragic. I mean, yeah, I'm happy to hear he's recognized.
I mean, it's tough. You know, these guys put their body on the line, and you know, Chuck, I don't know who's paying for all these medical things and having to do all that stuff, but I think it's just kind of one of those things in the sport that we're kind of seeing the first class of champions and kind of what this sport does to your body. And it's not a knock on the sport. It's just the reality of it. Every sport, you know, deals with it. And we're kind of now seeing it with the UFC.
You're 100% right. That's a phenomenal point, because I think for the longest time we had this notion where it's like, oh, it's not so bad, but it's only because the sport was so young. And when you start to see guys that made the sport what it is, and these faces that were larger than life, Chuck Liddell, Tito Ortiz, like these guys who are, you know, you see Chuck with a cane, it's shocking. This is common in boxing. Yeah. This is common in pro wrestling. This is common in every other combat sport, but it hasn't been common in our sport. That's just because the sport was in its infancy. So I think now we're going to start to get a bit of a rude awakening, at least those who believe that it's a lot safer than others are saying. And, you know, just the picture I saw of Chuck with the cane was a little jarring. But I'm happy to hear he's not going to fight anymore, because that would be a very bad idea. You've done other combat sports related docs. You've produced other combat sports related docs. Prison Fighters was a great one as well. Is this going to be
Mark Kriegel? Mark Kriegel was our writer for it. I heard him on right before me. I was like, it was great to hear his voice again.
That's right. That's right. I should have made that connection. Are you going to do another fighting doc next, or are you going to take a break?
You know, I don't know. I kind of don't know. I don't want to get pigeonholed into the MMA, you know, fighting world necessarily, but I kind of just chase whatever's the best story. You know, if it's a football story, if it's a soccer story, if it's, you know, whatever it is, I just kind of chase the biggest theme. I tend to pick like a theme that I'm really passionate about. And because if you find something that you're really passionate about as far as theme, it can actually keep you fueled throughout the grueling year, sometimes years that you're working on the project. It feels a little more important than just the immediate story. So whatever theme I can find that kind of excites me, I think I'll just keep moving in that direction.
I know how big of a deal it is for a filmmaker to have a 30 for 30. So congratulations on getting one on the resume, and congratulations on a great doc. It flew by watching it. It was a lot of fun. And I was honored to be in it for a little bit and just to see those faces and the old footage and the build up and all that stuff. It reminds the Fox Sports appearance by Tito that I remember watching in my dorm room back in the day that kind of opened my eyes to like, wow, this sport is actually a thing. It's still alive and well and people care.
Right.
Great find on your part. So congrats to you and the team. I really enjoyed it. And thank you for doing the show today.
Yeah, thank you, Ariel.
All right, all the best. There he is, Micah Brown, a great filmmaker. Again, Chuck and Tito is the name of the documentary. If you missed it, it is going to be on ESPN Plus beginning this Friday, I'm told, so you can watch it at your leisure. They've got all the 30 for 30s there, and if you are unfamiliar with 30 for 30, if you're just being introduced to it now because of this MMA one, and by the way, it's a big deal. First ever MMA 30 for 30 is a huge deal for the sport. Do yourself a favor and watch a lot of those 30 for 30s. They are phenomenal. TST, what's your favorite 30 for 30? Putting you on the spot.
My favorite 30 for 30 is the one about the Fab Five, the Michigan college basketball team, early 90s.
Jason Hare, a good friend of mine, produced that one. That was an amazing one. I really like King's Ransom about the Wayne Gretzky trade. And of course, the OJ Made in America one almost like doesn't even, it's not even fair to include that because that was a five-part series, an incredible one, an Oscar. But yeah, I can't really count that many that I didn't like. They were all phenomenal.
They're all so well done. The one about Nancy Kerrigan and Tanya Harding.
Oh, yes.
I was not alive during that scandal, or I was like very, very young during that scandal, but I hear it was like all the rage back when it happened.
Wait, you were alive though, right?
What year was it? Like 98 or something?
93?
Yeah.
Oh,
no, I was not alive.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, I was born in 95.
Come on. TST, I listen to, who's making me like sweat because Mark Kriegel has somewhere to be and I'm reading this ad. You were born in 1995?
Yeah.
1995?
Yeah,
I was
got
in
a problem
eighth
with
grade. No, I don't have a problem with it, but I would be lying if I said I didn't kind of view you in a different light now. What am I so worried about?
Did you not
about?
Know? You've seen me. You've met me in person several times, Eric. Do you not know how young I am?
You don't look like so. So 1995 is that 30?
December 31st, 1995.
31st?
Yeah. My birthday is always a party.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So wait, my math, 34? No, 24. You're only 24?
I'm 23, turning 24 in December.
Gosh, jeez Louise. I mean, it was very rude what you did earlier. Mark Krieger's waiting. There
hey,
you are.
We've got a review here.
Okay,
and
yes.
A question for you.
Yes.
So
what is this?
This is some
the
some
music
funky
review
tunes we got going here.
Okay.
This one comes from Overfiend175, who says, "Great podcast, by the way."
Thank you.
And he wants to know: shouldn't Reebok be assisting the UFC with redesigning the gloves after the Yair Rodriguez, Jeremy Stephens eye poke? You would think the UFC would make correcting this problem their highest priority at the moment.
Good question. Timely question, by the way, and thank you for the compliment as well. Yair and Jeremy are fighting on Friday in their rematch of the fight that happened in Mexico, the infamous eye poke fight that ended in just like 15 seconds. I don't know if that is Reebok's deal right now. Like they're the sponsor and they're making the shirts and they're making the shorts and things like that. But the gloves, that's a whole different ball game. You know, I think Reebok, I've seen Reebok boxing gloves. I don't even know if I've ever seen Reebok MMA gloves. And the UFC has talked about, Mark Ratner in particular has talked about, and Bellator as well, updating the gloves, making them a little more rounded, trying to eliminate the eye pokes by making them a little more rounded so that the hand can't go out straight. Nothing really has come of that. I know we've been talking about it over at the ESPN.com MMA team about, you know, what's the status of these updated gloves. But I wouldn't pin that on Reebok. I'm very curious. The deal started in 2015. I believe there's a year and a half left, if memory serves me correct. I'm very curious to see what happens when that deal is up, if Reebok is going to stick around. No secret that they took a bit of a PR hit with this, and I think it's gotten better over the years, but they've taken some heat, and a lot of it wasn't actually even their fault. I think they were kind of used as a scapegoat at times, but I wonder if they're going to stick around once this deal is done. I'm not saying that there's not going to be a sponsor, but I wonder if the main sponsor is still going to be Reebok when the deal is done. But I don't think it's fair. Again, speaking of scapegoat, look, a perfect example. It's not on Reebok to change that. To me, it's on the UFC to update it and to maybe work with a company in order to change that and limit the eye pokes. It's become a lot more prevalent these days. I think it kind of goes in waves. We saw like a stretch of like four straight events that a fight was stopped because of an eye poke, but I wouldn't pin that on Reebok.
Thanks for the question, Overfiend. If any of you want to leave a question for Ariel, just head to Apple Podcasts, Ariel Helwani's MMA Show. Leave us a rating and a question, and we'll try to get you on.
All right. Thank you very much. And please do continue to subscribe, rate, review, all those things and more. Because the more you do that, believe it or not, the less annoying TST is about the length of time. And even if you don't want to listen to the full show, just like scroll through the whole thing, because sometimes he likes to say, oh, people only listen to 96% of the show, and that's not quite good enough for me. Meanwhile, I look at all the other podcasts and everyone's like, oh, an hour and 30 minutes, an hour and 40 minutes, this, that, and the other. And no one seems to bother them, but only me. I'm the only one that gets the heat over here. You have anything to say for yourself?
You're not big time enough yet.
Oh, all right. Fair enough. But what a great day it has been. By the way, I did Ariel the Bad Guy earlier on ESPN Plus. That will be out tonight. I thought it was one of our better episodes, if I do say so myself. So check that out. Also on ESPN.com/MMA, my weekly thoughts column was posted this morning. Weigh in on a bunch of different things. So go check that out. And, of course, thank you very much to our guest this week, Mark Raimondi. Great stuff as always. Mark Kriegel, phenomenal stuff. Wow, I wish we did... Honestly, I wish we did a whole hour with Mark Kriegel. He was amazing. And Micah Brown, congratulations on the 30 for 30. Again, thank you very much to all of you. PFL playoffs on Thursday on ESPN2 and ESPN+. UFC in Boston, Dominic Reyes, Chris Weidman, very important fight at 205. Will the winner of that fight emerge as the number one contender in the light heavyweight division? Yair versus Stevens 2, or as Chael likes to call him, Yair. Deron Wynn. Joe Lozon is back. Molly McCann. It's a solid card. So that's this Friday. And then, of course, I'm back on Monday for the usual Helwani show. Thank you very much to TST. Thank you very much to all of you. Enjoy the rest of your week. Enjoy the fights. I'll talk to you next week.